and I pause, noticing an increase in the decibel of the shrieks, and glance outside through the side window. A night runner is climbing on the prop. I have the quick thought again of starting the engine, when the night runner is thrown from the propeller to the ground. "What the fuck?" I say, knowing instantly it's been shot off. I grab a set of NVGs lying on the bunk and step closer to the window to get a better look. I don't need them to see outside, but I am ever thoughtful of Gonzalez's words. I'm not ready for the others to know anything as yet and don't want to raise any eyebrows. I know I've already raised a couple, thinking back to Robert's reaction when I heard his whisper and to Greg's when I heard the vehicles long before he could. "What's up?" Greg asks as I slide the goggles down. The only change that occurs is the night changes from gray to green. However, one other thing becomes visible. There's a laser pointing down from the top of the aircraft, and it's aimed at one of the night runners. The night runner rocks backward, spins, and falls to the ground. "Holy shit, what the fuck?" I say again, louder this time. "There's someone shooting night runners from up top." "You're kidding," he says incredulously. "No, that I am not," I say, raising the goggles and heading quickly down the stairs to the cargo compartment. "What the hell is going on here?" I shout to the group standing near the back of the aircraft. I'm actually surprised to see them where Greg and I left them. I was expecting them to be standing around the top hatch. I look to the ladder and see the hatch closed. Heads turn in my direction, and I'm met with surprised looks, which confuses me even further. Judging from their reactions and their positions, they aren't aware that someone is on top shooting.
"But how can you not be aware someone climbed up the ladder and opened the hatch right next to you?"
I think, staring back at them. A stab of fear grips me. I scan the faces quickly and see Robert looking back at me with surprise still on his face. I can also see the cogs inside his head turning as he tries to figure out what I'm talking about. He knows something is amiss. He's hung around me long enough to know I don't just blurt shit out. Okay, well, I do, and often, but he also knows when I'm serious. One face, one very important face, is missing. The stab of fear doubles and drops from my heart to my stomach. I scan again. "Where the fuck is Bree?" I shout, knowing the answer. The group looks around in their minds, searching for her familiar face, expecting to see her standing near. She was there not long ago. I don't notice as I'm already climbing the ladder with Greg standing below me. He tells the others about my seeing someone on top shooting night runners outside. I register the instantaneous gasp from several, but I'm already pushing the hatch open. I poke my head through and see Bree on one knee by the wing root, her M4 at her shoulder. Her shoulder rocks back slightly in unison with the muted sound of a round leaving the chamber. A night runner running across the ramp towards the hangars drops in its tracks. Bree continues firing at individual night runners, watching them fall to the ramp below. Not being able to get to her, they howl and shriek in frustration. Some dip underneath the wing, trying to get out of her line of sight. She shifts her position and fires at another. She's careful with her shots, in order not to hit the aircraft or at too much of an angle that might ricochet up into the wing or engines. Another night runner drops to the ground. She hears a shout emanating below her. The shout has words attached to it, and she knows she's been found out, or at least missed. She worries about her dad's reaction and knows it won't be a pretty one. A shriek sounds loud above the others. The total volume has diminished to a large degree, as there is not the same number of mouths to emit those screams. Dead night runners lie on the tarmac around the 130.
"Like fish in a barrel,"
she thinks, lining up another shot. With the loud shriek, the night runners turn as one and begin pounding across the ramp. She hears the hatch behind her open as she cracks off another shot at a fleeing night runner. It falls forward from the round, slamming into its back. The remainder scatter, disappearing between the hangars and into the night.
Bree, what the hell are you doing? Get the fuck back in here, now!
She hears her dad's sharply whispered voice.
Bree, what the hell are you doing? Get the fuck back in here, now!
I say, watching the last of the night runners disappear between the hangars. I keep my voice down to a harsh whisper as I don't want to startle her to the point of actually falling off. I thought of going to grab the back of her vest to prevent that, but that may have startled her even more and she could have put a round into the aircraft. The silence of the night returns, with the exception of my rapidly pounding heart. I watch as Bree calmly rises, clears the chamber before reinserting a mag, flips the safety on, and shoulders her M4. She walks toward me in the hatch, lifting her goggles. She has grim determination painted across her features. Her eyes are large from the adrenaline that must be flooding inside of her. It's not really a look I wanted to see on my little girl, unless I was watching her during one of her sporting events, or if she was studying for a final. But I also know her. I head down the ladder with Bree climbing down after me. She closes and seals the hatch. Into the cockpit, now, I point as her boots hit the deck with a ring. I'm relieved she's safe. Relieved is putting it mildly. But I'm also pissed. See the aforementioned times when the fear resolves itself. I watch Bree as she walks ahead of me to the steps leading upward. Watching my 15-year-old daughter walking in her black fatigues and vest with an M4 slung on her shoulder and NVGs on her head is disconcerting. Her fine blonde hair hangs down to the middle of her back. This is my sweet girl walking in front of me, I think. I feel my anger subside to a degree, or at least be redirected toward the situation that would make my girl have to wear that attire and carry such gear. I do notice her confident stride. It's like I'm seeing her in a different light. My sweet, bubbly, joyous, carefree girl has changed, and I'm not too happy with the world for making that so. The interior of the aircraft is deathly silent. We enter the cockpit, and she sits on the lower bunk, removing her goggles. I plop down beside her.
What the hell were you thinking, Bree? I ask, shaking my head.
I don't know, Dad. I just got really scared and felt the need to do something,
Bree answers.
Seriously, and that's what you came up with? Opening the hatch and going outside with the night runners? You endangered everyone here opening that hatch like that, I say with my voice rising.
I made sure the hatch was closed so they couldn't have gotten in, she replies.
Okay, I'll give her that one. It's still not okay, but she's right. That doesn't alleviate my anger and fear any, or make what she did right. But you could have disabled the aircraft shooting at the night runners around it, either directly or by a ricochet.
Dad, I was careful with my shot so that didn't happen,
she says. I take another long, hard look at my daughter sitting in front of me.
Could she really have analyzed it in that fashion, being outside in the domain of the night runners?
The girl sitting in front of me seems like a completely different person than my daughter. And yet, the same.
Okay, but you went outside with the night runners and you went alone. They could have climbed up and gotten to you, Bree. I feel the beginnings of a tear thinking about if that had happened.
I've observed them at night and they haven't been able to climb on top. They would have if they could on nights past, and we would have heard them banging on top,
she responds.
Quit being so damn logical, I say, raising my voice.
You scared me to death, Bree, I add in a lower tone. You didn't let anyone know where you were or where you were going.
I know you're angry with me, Dad, and I'm sorry.
Bree drops her eyes to stare at her lap. Damn right I'm angry. I'm pissed as hell. But that's because I was scared to death. Bree raises her eyes back to mine.
That's how I feel, Dad. I'm scared and I'm angry. I don't want you to go. Why do you have to do this?
Here it is. This is what it comes down to. I come to the realization that there are two balances in progress. One is in relation to them and me trying to come to grips with keeping them safe versus giving them experience. But there's another, and that is taking risks myself versus staying around for them. I've always had that in the back of my mind, but I guess the Superman aspect I felt from time to time never really let me think about that for too long or deeply. I guess I always knew that I would make it through, and I'd always be around, so that wasn't really ever a player. They want to gather the experience, and I want them to be held in safety. They don't want me to take risks and to be around, and I feel the need to take some risks for the safety of others. I'm not sure that balance will ever come up with the perfect answer, but I can understand hers and Robert's perspective a little more. My sweet Bree, I owe these people. They risk their lives to help keep you safe. They helped without question and risked everything to get you back. And now their families are in trouble and need help, I say, trying to help her understand why I take the risks I do.
But you won't let us take those risks to help the others who've helped us, she says.
I know. When you have kids, you'll better understand why, I reply, and give her the same talk I gave Robert about it being tough being a dad and weighing the risks of giving them experience against the need to see them safe. Oh, and about the having kids thing, that better not be soon, I add after trying to explain how difficult it is being a dad in this new world. Bree smiles.
I'm sorry I disappointed you, Dad.
Bree, you could never disappoint me. I wrap my arms around her and draw her close. She folds her arms around me and I feel warm tears run down my cheeks onto her shoulder.
I love you, Dad,
she says against my shoulder. I love you too, Bree. I look up to see Gonzalez standing at the bottom of the steps. I'm not sure how long she's been there. She looks at me and nods at Bree, asking if she can talk to her. This is my time with my daughter, and I give Gonzalez a look, letting her know she is treading on dangerous ground. Gonzalez reads my look, nods her understanding, but holds her ground.
Sir, this is just one soldier to another,
Gonzalez says, nodding at Bree, who still has my arms wrapped around her. I nod in understanding, release Bree, and rise, giving her a kiss on the forehead. I head back into the cargo compartment.
Bree feels her dad release his hold and the kiss on her head. She knows what she did was wrong. Not from a purely logical standpoint, but more from acting without letting the group know first. What if her dad didn't know she was on the roof? He would have charged out of the aircraft and into the midst of the night runners looking for her. She knows he would have taken on every night runner to find her. She did, in fact, put others at risk with her actions. Gonzalez sits beside her.
You want to talk about it?
Gonzalez asks.
Not really,
Bree answers, looking at her lap once again.
Let me rephrase that. Wanna talk about it?
Gonzalez asks again, but with very little question attached to it. Bree looks up and smiles.
She really does like Gonzalez, and is afraid of disappointing her almost more than her dad. She admires Gonzalez, and likes how she makes her feel comfortable with just a few words. Gonzalez can climb around, over, and through her walls with ease. She feels a similar connection with Gonzalez as she did with Nick. Not the same, but close.
"I don't know what got into me," Bree says. "I was just so scared for my dad. I still am."
"Bree, one thing you are going to have to trust is that your dad knows what he is doing, and that whatever he does, he has you and Robert first and foremost in his mind,"
Gonzalez says, putting her hand on Bree's shoulder.
"I can understand some of that, and I know the reasons, but I still don't really get why he has to take the risks that he does,"
Bree replies.
"Look, I know it seems like he does reckless and risky things at times, but understand that he is mindful of what he is doing, and know that he does know his limits, although I do sometimes question if he knows exactly where they are, and instead plays it by ear. But he does know what he is doing. Have faith that he will not do anything that will result in him leaving you. This is a dangerous world we live in, and nothing is ever guaranteed, but he won't excessively risk himself if it means you will lose him. He takes these risks for others, but only because they have risked their lives for you and Robert. He is merely paying them back for your safety,"
Gonzalez says.
"How do you know all of this?"
Bree asks.
"Because I've known others like him,"
Gonzalez answers. Bree understands and appreciates her dad more. She feels her fears settle and become acceptance. Not a faded kind of acceptance. She's still scared about what's coming up. Bree feels the tempered steel build and become a stronger part of her.
"How many did you get?" Gonzalez asks.
"I'm not sure," Bree answers.
"I guess we'll find out in the morning."
"I guess so," Bree replies, feeling a little shy.
"Well, little warrior princess, you sure chased them off,"
Gonzalez says, patting her shoulder before rising. Bree's heart swells with pride. She still knows she did wrong and put others at risk, but those words from Gonzalez fill her. Words escape her, but nothing can wipe the smile off her face. That smile says it all.
"Come on, let's head into the back and get some rest," Gonzalez says.
Bree rises and follows Gonzalez. I walk down the steps, not sure if I feel better or not. The thought of Bree outside by herself picking off night runners in their domain sends shivers up my spine and a sour, sickening feeling in my stomach. She did it because she was scared and felt the need to act.
"Is that why I'm doing half of the things I am, feeling the need to act? Was she being reckless, or am I just thinking she was? She was quite logical in her thinking and seemed in control of herself. I mean, it's something I might even do. Is that recklessness, or have I reasoned it out in my head to make it seem like a legit risk? Do the others view my actions as reckless and just go along with it because?"
I know Lynn has issues with some of my decisions, and I truly can't say I blame her. These thoughts pour through my mind as I enter the cargo compartment and take a seat on the lower bunk by the blacked-out window. The soldiers stand silently, looking everywhere but in my direction. There's an awkward feeling to the air. Robert comes to sit next to me.
"How'd it go up there?" he asks.
"All in all, not too bad," I answer.
"You know, not one person saw her climb up."
"Yeah, I figured as much."
"Why'd she do it?" Robert asks.
I explain as best I can.
"I can relate," Robert says after I finish.
I look sidelong at him.
"Really?"
I ask. "How so?"
"Well, I get worried and feel the need to act. I feel kind of stifled sometimes,"
he answers.
I understand why you do what you do, but it sometimes comes up.
Okay, let me ask you this. Do you think I act recklessly? I ask. He gives his customary shrug. Seriously, do you? I ask again. He sighs.
No, not recklessly, I guess. But you do take some pretty big risks. Then again, you have different experiences, so what I see as big risks, you see differently.
And that's a good way of putting it.
But jumping into a compound at night with a halo jump, well, that's different. When is the last time, if ever, you've done that?
Robert asks, looking at me worriedly. It's been a while, admittedly.
Then why?
Now it's my turn to sigh. Go get Greg and I'll explain. He was asking the same thing, and if everyone's asking, then perhaps I either need to reconsider or explain. Robert gets up and returns shortly with Greg. Okay, so here's the deal. Like I mentioned to Bree, I feel the need to do this because these people helped and risked themselves to rescue yourself and Bree. Now their families need help, and I can give it, I say, addressing Robert for the most part.
I understand that, Robert says.
Now, Greg, if you don't feel comfortable doing it, and I can certainly understand why you wouldn't, then please say so and be assured I won't hold any ill feelings, I say.
No, Jack, like I said before, I'll support you all the way with whatever you decide. I just wanted to talk it through and make sure we weren't committing to an endeavor that we shouldn't. Sometimes we can get compulsive about an idea and force an answer. I just wanted to make sure we weren't doing that in this case.
I want you to feel free to develop those kinds of conversations whenever you see fit, I say. Besides, we may not find the equipment we need, rendering this whole thing moot. Greg merely nods. I call Horace over.
You know, sir, everyone feels bad for not seeing Bree. Each person feels responsible,
Horace says on arriving. It's not anyone's fault. Make sure they know that. Sit with your teams and ensure they know there is nothing to feel bad about. Bree made her decision and acted, not wanting anyone to catch her. I think she sees the light now. At least I hope so. But it's no one's fault, I reply.
I know they'll be happy to hear that you don't think they let you down, she says.
Oh, for Pete's sake, no one here has let anyone down in the slightest. Tell your teams there's no use in getting their panties in a... Oh, crap, I say, looking up. I'm sorry.
No worries, sir,
Horace responds with a smile. The point is, there's no use getting all bunched up over nothing. There's enough real shit to worry about without making stuff up. Now, let's get some rest. We have another long day tomorrow, I finish.
Roger that, sir,
Horace says. We bed down, and I turn off the battery switch, plunging the interior into darkness. No one ever looks up. I wake with a start. The warm sleeping bag is wrapped around my body, but there's a chill in the air I feel on my cheeks, despite being in the aircraft with so many others. I'm a little groggy, as if we've sucked all the oxygen out of the air during the night. Lying on the hard floor, I feel stymied by the choices ahead of me. I don't want to leave the warmth of the bag, but I'm not overly fond of continuing to lie on the hard deck either. And there's just no right answer. Well, my bladder actually tells me different, and it eventually wins the argument. I unzip the bag and peel it back. The chill instantly fills the once warm bag. I sense a stirring of the others. Being in the heat yesterday has made us more weary than normal. I turn on my light and stumble to the cockpit to check whether night has passed. The light sky in the east lets me know that dawn is upon us, and the beginning of another day. It's going to be a long one, and Greg and I will have to find time to rest at some point before the evening sets in. The night runners left us alone for the rest of the night, and I'm grateful for the little rest I did get. I open the crew door, letting in the early morning light. The cool, fresh air sweeps in through the open door and is invigorating after the stale air of the interior. I walk down the steps, eyeing the bodies of night runners lying on the tarmac near the aircraft. Bree certainly took down a number of them. Dried and drying pools surround the bodies and run in rivulets following the low spots on the concrete. Several chunks of dry brain tissue lie in places. If we were staying longer, I would have the bodies removed, but we're leaving shortly, and I don't want to waste time or energy. I'm feeling low on energy and not ready for what I know the day and evening hold. The events of last night and what is coming up make me feel a touch overwhelmed. I'm just feeling old and want to crawl back to my little cottage to sleep for a month. The rear ramp lowers. Apparently others are up and not appreciating our locker room. I watch as soldiers emerge, stretching their tired muscles and staring at the bodies. "Well, if we're gonna do this, then let's do this," I say to myself, and start a walk around of the aircraft. Glancing back at the door, I see Gonzalez and Bree standing at the opening. "Damn, girl," I hear Gonzalez say. "That's pretty impressive." I watch as Bree smiles at the compliment. "That's nothing to be proud of," I say loudly, not wanting Bree to think what she did was okay.
"I know, Dad,"
she says back loudly, losing her smile. "But it is impressive," I say, to which the smile returns. I finish the walk around as soldiers gather on the ramp to look at Bree's little circle of destruction and to break open a few meals. I hear a few whistles as some start strolling around the bodies. I am impressed with her body count, but not the way she went about it. I want to put a stop to their being impressed in case Bree's thinking circles back to feeling it's okay to do what she did. Honestly, though, I don't believe she will. So, I let them continue. The flight back to Kirtland will be a short one, but we'll have to find out which building houses the equipment we'll need, and then retrieve it, which will mean going into a darkened building once again. Something I'm not too keen on doing. Maybe I'll just vanish when I get back and find that cabin in the woods. Perhaps we'll meet up with Sergeant Prescott and he'll know if and where we could find it. He mentioned he was with the base security detachment, so he'll know which buildings are which. The sun breaks over the horizon, casting its brilliant light across the ramp, and changes the morning from a blue-shaded one to one filled with yellowish orange. The sky remains clear of clouds. It promises to be another warm one. I hope it remains clear through the night. There's no way I'm going to do this if any storms or low clouds develop. It's been a long while since I've done something like this, and I'd like a clear night to do it in, thank you. We load the vehicles, fold back into the aircraft, and I have Robert and Craig make the short hop back. We'll all brief later if it's decided that we'll go. There's a lot of setup to do with the flight computer for a drop like this, and I want to cover how to fly it in detail. Really, it's not that tough once the setup is complete, but I want it to be as precise as possible. I mean, if we get dropped way off target, well, that puts us outside the walls at night. Not a pretty thought at all. That would really suck to have our chutes open and find us drifting into downtown Lubbock. Yeah, I'd probably try to climb up the risers in an effort to stay airborne a touch longer. Robert starts the engines, blowing some of the bodies behind the giant props down the ramp a ways. At first, the wind pushes at their clothing as the propellers gain speed, and then the ones lying across the flow of the hurricane-force winds begin to tumble and roll. Dust also blows behind the aircraft as we roll out to the runway. The engines rumble louder as Robert pushes the throttles up, and we're soon airborne, leaving the messy ramp behind. The flight is a short and unremarkable one. Unremarkable, that is, until I realize it's my son flying us, and I feel comfortable with that. Also, I'll be letting him fly tonight on the drop. I'm not sure that anything has remained the same since the world came crashing down. He sets us down at Kirtland with a pretty good landing, and we taxi into our previous parking spot. As the propellers wind down, I see several people dressed in ACUs leave the tower and head our way. We watch as they draw nearer, their long shadows stretching alongside of them to the west. They carry their carbines casually as they approach. I observe them quickly through a set of binoculars and recognize Sergeant Prescott among them. Catching a quick glint of light from the tower, I observe someone on the walkway circling the outside, pointing a rifle in our direction. Another flash of light enters my magnified view, confirming a scope of some kind is aimed in our direction. Sergeant Prescott is being cautious as well, or at least providing himself a backup. With the aircraft shutdown procedures finished, I open the crew door and step outside. I'm not that keen on stepping out where a sniper has a gun trained, but with the way Prescott and the others are approaching over the open ramp, I figure he's just being cautious and not planning to ambush us. I have Greg keep an eye on the one on the tower. Prescott apparently recognizes me and waves after speaking into the mic at his collar. I see a final glint from the upper tower area, and Greg informs me that the person has left the perch and retreated inside. With a small sigh of relief, the tension leaves. I think about the time we will still be down here, and I wish I could get a message back to Lynn. I know she'll be worrying about our extended absence, but there's no way we can communicate with her or the group. As Prescott continues walking to the aircraft, I give a thought, hoping that they're all doing well. "I love you, and we'll see you soon," I whisper to the heavens, while staring at the blue sky. "Sergeant Prescott," I say, extending my hand.
"Jack, sir,"
he says, taking my hand. "Yeah, just Jack," I respond. "Are you heading back?" Prescott asks. "Well, not immediately, but soon," I answer.
"Well, we talked about it, and if your offer still stands, we'd like to join you when you do,"
he says.
"Of course it does, and we'd be glad to have you. We found some others in Lubbock, so it'll be a little crowded, but I'm sure we'll find room," I say, and fill him in on some of the details of our plan. I finish by asking, "You wouldn't happen to know if there were still PJs training here, specifically any jump equipment?"
There was a detachment in that building." He points to a tan brick building next to a set of hangars.
"I'm not sure about equipment, though. I know they have or had an equipment room inside."
"Any night runners?" I ask, referring to whether there were any actually inside said building.
"I know they're on base almost every night, but who knows where the fuck they hide out."
"All right. Let's get the vehicles offloaded. Greg, the building looks small enough for one team. Let's take your Echo team and have a look around," I say. "Prescott, you're welcome to join our briefing later if you want."
"Okay. We aren't doing any supply runs today, so I'd be happy to," he responds.
He heads off with his group towards the tower as Blue and Red Team unhook and begin backing the first of the Humvees out. Greg and Echo Team see to their gear. I check my mags, radio, and NVGs as well. I have Robert join me and notify Gonzalez that Red Team will be on backup just outside the doors.
"Does that mean Bree, sir?"
Gonzalez asks. "Yes, with Bree, but make sure she is glued to your side," I answer. I guess the scales are swinging toward gaining experience today. The second vehicle is backed out onto the sun-filled ramp. The heat is climbing, and I still smell a touch of the slaughter yard of the day prior on my clothes. I think about switching clothes or finding some wood to smoke ourselves in. The smell of dead and rotting flesh is liable to make the night runners start drooling and bring them running if they're inside. I feel so tired, and I'm on the edge of just letting it go, but realize that tired leads to shortcuts, and shortcuts lead to mistakes. Mistakes we can't afford to make. Some of the soldiers stand around the second Humvee, gulping down water. We're all a tired group, far away from home. I wonder if they feel like they're on a tour of duty. It's similar, but we're at least on home soil and not scheduled to be away for a year. I know I'm feeling like being back home in the Northwest. The sanctuary at Cabela's seems surreal at the moment, like it's a dream we're trying to get back to. It's only a 4-hour flight, but it feels like it's on the other side of the world. I call Horace over. Take Blue Team and a Humvee to find some dry wood and branches with leaves, I say.
Will do, sir,
she answers and strolls away, gathering up the rest of Blue Team. They gather their gear together and, with a slamming of doors which echoes across the warming ramp, drive off between two hangars. Horace shouldn't have far to go, as most bases, regardless of where they may be located, like to keep up their appearances with trees and such. The green branches may be hard to come across, as the watering systems which kept them that way haven't worked in some time. They return after a while with several armloads of both dry and leafy branches. We build a fire on the tarmac well away from the aircraft and any underground fuel locations. The last thing I need right now is to make a huge smoking hole in the ground. With the fire going, I toss on the greenery, creating a small amount of smoke, which we bathe our clothes in, trying to remove the dead cow and sweat smells. Standing next to the fire, with the sun beating down in the mid-morning sky, brings additional sweat, so it may be a moot point trying to cover ourselves with smoke. We check for rounds in the chamber and pat our gear for assurances before heading over to the building pointed out by Prescott. It's a smaller building adjacent to the ramp behind a line of MC-130 aircraft. Robert is by my side as we stroll across the ramp and between two of the aircraft. Red and Echo teams follow behind, their boots striking the hard surface, the only sound in the area. A blue Air Force pickup truck is parked in front of the tan single-story building. A single entrance door is set in the middle, with a set of steel double doors to the left. A tattered U.S. flag barely hangs on the outside concrete wall to the right. We walk to the shaded west side of the building and circle up near the set of double doors. I'm thinking these lead to the equipment room, as opposed to the single door, which may lead to any admin offices that may be inside. At least, that's been my experience. The double doors usually mean crew doors. Of course, it could just lead to a large janitor's closet, for all I know. With the door on the side of the structure, it means that we'll have less angles to cover, which makes it easier. And I'm all for easier. Okay, Echo Team is in. Red Team, be ready to cover, whether that's providing fire for a retreat or entering for additional support. Keep in mind we may be retreating and watch your fire. Robert, you're with me. Greg, your team's in first. Robert and I will follow and back up where needed, I say. The tiredness has vanished from the soldiers and is replaced by their game faces. This is a darkened building, and no matter how small it might be, it could still house night runners. We're treading into their domain, and that will always increase the pucker factor. I reach out for a split second and don't sense any night runners. That can't be taken as fact, though. If I can shield myself, so can they. There's no evidence outside that there are any night runners inside, but neither is there anything that shows there aren't.
No prob, Jack. See you inside,
Greg says, turning to his team and organizing them around the door. Two take the handles and test them to see if they're unlocked. Both doors open an inch and they give Greg a nod. The others stack up in front of the doors, ready to enter when the doors swing open. Robert and I are behind Echo.
Stay close, I whisper to Robert. I'm right beside you, he replies.
Greg nods and the doors swing open. I feel a jolt of electricity as adrenaline floods my system. Goggles are brought down upon entry, and Echo rushes in. Cool air spills out, and the sound of boots pounds first on concrete and then linoleum. Robert and I take the doors as the two remaining Echo team members enter and join the others. The sounds of our entry diminish as each team member takes his or her position inside. I peer in to see an open room with workbenches along two of the walls and a large wooden table bolted in the middle of the floor. Echo team is standing in a semicircle, a few feet inside, sweeping the area. I have Gonzalez and McCafferty hold the doors open to allow some of the daylight to penetrate the room. Robert and I step in. The room is small, but not small enough to allow the ambient light to penetrate its width or length. Much of the room is left in darkness. We slide in behind Greg, and I tap him on the shoulder, letting him know we're there. Thin beams of light pan out, searching every nook and corner. Nothing screeches, nor is there the sound of pounding feet heading our way. The room is tomb-like in its silence. Another set of double steel doors is set against the wall to our right. One of the walls has large wooden pegs, some of which are empty, while others hold parachutes, hanging by the shoulder straps. Other parachutes lie on some of the workbenches, and one, with its silk chute draping out of the pack, is on the large work table in the middle. The far wall has an array of shelving with equipment and boxes situated on them. For one of the first times inside a building, there are no bodies on the ground in some stage of decay. Greg directs two of his team to the steel doors on the right. The yellow tape on the floor, taped in arcs, indicates that the doors swing inwards. I locate a metal rod under one of the workbenches and walk over to the door, sliding it through the door handles. If anyone does try to breach the room, the rod should hold the doors closed for a bit and give us a warning. There aren't the usual small windows inset in the doors, so I have no idea what lies on the other side, but I'm guessing it's a larger equipment room, as this is apparently the packing room. Greg looks over to the chutes on the pegs and nods. We walk over to inspect the racks. I know we'll be hard-pressed to find a chute that's been packed within the last 4 months, 120 days, as the world has been changed almost that long, but it's worth a look. Hopefully someone had the foresight to pack two MC4 rigs just before succumbing, knowing we would show up and need them, maybe as his or her last act. That would be sweet. There are four MC4 rigs packed that are over the 120 days, but not by much. A couple of rigs are way over. The shelves hold a few helmets along with some empty rucksacks. There are even a couple of wrist altimeters. I grab those and stash them in the side pockets of my fatigues while handing Robert two helmets with visors and goggles attached. I'm jolted upright as a very familiar tickle eases into my mind, and it's not a comfortable one. Someone or something has awakened. I guess I'm not able to either sense them when they're asleep or they can block me out. And perhaps I didn't open up enough. This is all still so new to me. Whatever the case, night runners are here, and close. The sound of running feet enters my range of hearing. "They're in here and on to us," I say, and I flick my selector switch to auto. A shriek sounds from the other side of the door. "You think?" Greg says as a slam hits the double doors. The doors bow inward, but are stopped by the bar through each of the handles. "Fuck me," Robert says, bringing his M4 up, aiming at the doors. I hear the click of his M4 as he slides the selector switch. The sudden jolt of adrenaline is a physical presence in each and every one of us. "Greg, the chutes," I yell, grabbing one of the later packed rigs off the pegs. Greg quickly grabs another, hoisting it on his shoulder and bringing his M4 to bear on the doors. The doors bang partially open again. The rod slides partway through one of the handles and is on the verge of falling out altogether. "Echo team, we're leaving," Greg says. I touch Robert's shoulder and nod toward the outside doors and the light. He nods and we begin backing up quickly with our carbines aimed at the doors where night runners are about to enter. We make sure to keep our aim points away from the two soldiers who were by the doors and are backing up as well. Screams fill the room from just a few feet away, with only a set of doors between us and them. Another slam pushes the doors open a little before they swing back closed. The rod falls from the handles to the concrete floor with a ringing metallic clang. We are now only a door slam away from however many night runners are in the other room. I open up and sense only a few of them, but in this enclosed room, a few will be too many. I sense a quick, startled series of images before shutting down again. Robert is backing up with me, and the other team members are to the side of us. Greg is offset in front with the other two who were by the door. A silence ensues, and we can only hear our own panting. The room may be smaller, but everything is happening rapidly, and yet slowly. The bangs against the now unblocked door are happening quickly, but it seems we're backing to the outside door very slowly. If the Night Runners enter, it'll be mayhem, and we'll only get a few rounds out before they're upon us. Another metallic bang against the doors, and they both fly inward. Shrieking Night Runners pour into the small room immediately behind the opening doors. The room lights up with flashes as Greg and the front two team members open fire on the first to enter. Two Night Runners stop as if they hit an invisible wall. One is launched heavily against the far open door, hits it with a thud, and slumps downward. The second is flung backwards and disappears from view. Others enter right on their heels. The safety of light is near but seemingly far, as we're still encapsulated within the darker reaches of the room. We're backing steadily. We will be caught if we turn and run. We continue backing quickly as Greg and the other two open fire again. Three Night Runners enter through the ones falling. They crouch as if about ready to launch at our team members in front. I don't have a good line of sight to add my fire. The Night Runners pause, howl, and turn back through the doors into the other room. I look down, seeing a lighter shade of concrete under my feet. We've reached the light pouring in from the outside. The Night Runners must have known they would be launching themselves into the daylight. One of the far doors swings slowly closed. The other is held open by a Night Runner lying on the cold concrete floor. We pour outside and into the shadow of the building. The heat envelops us, feeling even warmer after coming from the coolness within. Our breathing comes out in gasps as we shake off the intense adrenaline rush. Here, in the radiant light, the last few moments seem a touch surreal, even though it happened only seconds ago. I sure do hate darkened buildings. They don't seem to like me much either. My heart is pounding in my chest, and it feels like I just can't catch my breath. Greg drops his chute on the ramp as the outside doors close with a soft clang. "That was fucking close," he says. "You got that right," another of his team says. I'm staring at the now closed double doors. The clang of their closing brought a deep feeling of dread. Well, perhaps not as deep as when I first sensed the Night Runners within, but I nevertheless have a coldness in the pit of my stomach. I drop my chute to the ground, still looking at the doors. I hear the helmets Robert had looped around his arms by the straps hit the ground. Both of them notice me eyeing the doors and turn to look.
"What, you don't think they're coming out, do you?"
Robert asks, bringing his M4 up slightly. "No, but you know what this means, don't you?" I reply.
"What?"
Greg asks, as his breathing settles. Red team formed around us on our exit and are all looking at me. The Night Runners can manipulate and open doors. Not locked ones, perhaps, but definitely unlocked ones, I say. I see gears turn in the minds around me. Some eyes grow bigger as the meaning of what I said sinks in.
"What do you mean, sir?"
Denton asks. "Well, those are the only doors in," I say, pointing to the two sets of doors. "They didn't break their way in, so they had to open those doors. They had to know what they were and how to use them, whether by accident or not. They can open them."
"All they had to do was push on them, though."
Denton is a touch confused and not really getting it. I don't blame him. Adrenaline is still flowing, and it can sometimes confuse the logical part of the mind as the system is in fight-or-flight mode.
"But they had to open them in the first place," Robert says. "They wouldn't be alive if they couldn't have gotten out, and they wouldn't be in there if they got out and couldn't open the doors to get back in.
Denton now joins the others with wider eyes. The ramifications are large, and it was one of the things I worried about. Well, at least we know now. But the ramifications could be even further reaching.
Could they operate doors if they had turning handles? And if that's the case, can they get inside the aircraft or any other place? They hadn't in the nights we'd been out on the ramp, but we can't put it past them to be able to, I think.
Now, one thing for sure is that we won't be able to positively tell if night runners are inside a structure by broken doors or glass anymore, I say, bending to pick up the chute again. We'll have to tie the crew door shut and chain the rear ramp closed from here on out if we have to stay in an aircraft overnight. I make a mental note to include that in the briefing this afternoon. I want to plan the infill with Greg first. Then we'll cover the drop itself and the plan for the next day with the others. The adrenaline is beginning to fade, leaving me feeling like a limp noodle. It's a long day of planning ahead, followed by a long night. We drag our equipment back to the aircraft. Robert walks alongside, carrying the helmets while I hump the rig.
"Thanks for letting me go in," Robert says.
"What? Oh, don't thank me for something like that," I say. "We go into a building with night runners, and you thank me for not only letting you go in, but for me taking you in? Somewhere down the line, I've gone drastically awry with your upbringing. You should be kicking me in the ass for dragging your butt in there." He smiles, knowing I'm not serious. Well, not terribly serious. That was close enough. Of course, any time a night runner issues one of those shrieks, it's too close. What kind of dad am I that his son thanks him for taking him into such a place? I shake my head, thinking over the times we've shared. Perhaps I shouldn't have done half of the things with him that I have. Maybe that one time he collided with the corner of a doorframe hard enough to embed a paint chip in his forehead did something to him after all. I, of course, had nothing to do with said collision. Nope, not one little bit.
"Are you really going to jump tonight?"
he asks, eyeing the chute hanging on my shoulder by one strap. "Yeah, I'm guessing so. Not really sure why at this particular moment in time as we walk across this fucking hot ramp, but I guess I will," I answer.
"Are you worried about it? I mean, seeing how it's been a while?"
"Well, let's see. Out of date packing on the chute, at night over unfamiliar terrain, hoping to not jump into a nest of night runners in the midst of a feeding frenzy, and if we do hit our mark, then again it's into an unknown and a potential group of bad guys. That's also assuming we hit our altitude right and I don't bounce a mile back up. What's to worry about?" "I'm just kidding," I say, seeing a stricken look cross his features. Sometimes my humor misses its mark widely. "I'm a little worried, but not more than any other time. If I wasn't a little worried, then I'd be worried. Hey, if the spirits were going to take me, they'd have done so already. It's not like I try to get them to open the door, but I've also given them their chance 100 times over. I'll be fine. If you fear death and think about it all the time trying to avoid it, it'll come seeking you. It's like playing sports or when we'd be off gallivanting in the hills. If you think about getting hurt and ease up trying not to get hurt, that's when you do. It's not that you can go seeking it either. If you keep your awareness about you and steer clear of stupidity, things work out. The hard part is determining between whether something is a valid risk or just stupidity."
"For some reason, I know that you'll be okay. But that doesn't alleviate the worry on my end. I just hope I do it right," he says.
"You'll do fine, Robert. I have all the confidence in the world in you," I reply, patting his shoulder, to which he smiles. And look, with regards to having you join me, the scales on the experience versus wanting to keep you safe swing each day. But I'm not going to be around forever. "Yeah, I know. Hard to believe, huh?" I say with a smile. "So, You have to learn how to lead and make the right decisions. Only experience can give you that. That and a good head on your shoulders. But you already have that.
But there are plenty of people to lead. Lynn, Dreskel, Gonzalez, Greg, lots of others,
Robert says as we draw near the open 130 ramp. We drop our gear, but both know the conversation isn't over for either of us. The teams walk wearily by and up the ramp into the aircraft. Robert and I sit in the shade, with the massive tail looming above us. Bree walks up and sits with us, listening. True, and they're damn good at it, too. Better than me, if truth be told. But here's the thing, and it may only be true for me, and this is only between you and me. I think the only reason I'm still around is because I've been allowed to lead in times past. I think if I'd had to follow all the time, I wouldn't have made it this far. Don't ask me why, because I don't really know that one myself. I just know it, I say. There are times when I know when I have to do something alone, because I don't want the distraction of worrying about others, because I know the skills I have will be enough to get the task done. But there are also times when I know I need others, and I want them and their individual skills and gifts. Each and every one has their own special gift, which can save your life without you even knowing it. A team blends and becomes a single entity made up of all of those skills. That's what a leader does and is. A person that's a catalyst that allows those skills to blend into one, and the one others look to make a decision. It sometimes doesn't matter what the decision is, as long as it appears it's the right one and makes sense. As long as a decision is made, I say, feeling winded but trying to impart what little wisdom I may possess. I might also just be adding a lot of hot air to an already warm day. Maybe I was the one who single-handedly brought on global warming just by talking. It's possible. It doesn't matter what the decision is, just make one. Talk about it or think about it later, right? He says with a smile. The smile is because that's something I used to say to him a lot when he was younger and couldn't make a decision. It's good to know that some of what I've said in the past has been heard. Exactly, I reply. Remember when I would just stand in the candy bar aisle forever and couldn't decide which one to get? You'd say, just pick one. If you go home and feel you wanted the other, well, then you'll know next time, right? He says. Yeah, maybe I was a little hard on you sometimes. I just didn't want to stand in that candy bar aisle forever, and we would have. And you, young lass, I say, looking at Bree, we did spend days with you trying to decide. Bree smiles, thinking back to those days. I just don't know how to become a leader like the others, Robert says. First of all, you already have, or at least started. You both have. How so? Robert asks, puzzled. Bree tilts her head to the side, puzzled as well. Well, who flew us here making decisions and delegating tasks? Who made the hard decisions on a pretty significant weather divert? I ask rhetorically. But that's different, Robert says. My turn. How so? I ask. Because I knew how to fly it and get us here. Bingo. You knew how to do something and how to use the skills of others to get to a certain place, I say. It's no different than leading in other circumstances. If you know something with some degree of intimacy, you can lead in it. That's why I give you both the additional training, so you can learn how to do something. You need to think along those lines when we're training. Remember that you're learning something you can lead others in. And you, Bree, you know the systems and are teaching others and leading them. It's all the same thing.
But there are others who know how to do things and can't lead, and some who the others don't want to follow, Bree says.
That's very true. You have to have a degree of understanding others and what they're going through. every person is different. They have different experiences and ways of dealing with shit. And you have to find out how they respond effectively. You have to show that you have a measure of compassion without it interfering with your task. Sometimes you have to tell people to just suck it up. You're their leader, not their best friend. The bottom line, however, is if people believe you will get them through a situation, then they'll follow you through it. Show you care about them at the same time, and they'll follow you anywhere, I reply. Makes sense, Robert says. How do you learn that, though? Study people, and watch their reactions to different things, and don't ever fake compassion or understanding. People, especially soldiers, will see through that in a heartbeat. Always be yourself. The other thing with regards to leading is always study past actions in your head. Study mistakes and the things done right. Analyze every detail and think how you could or would have done it differently. Think of scenarios, no matter how wild or crazy, and think your way through it. If you come to an impasse, back up and rethink it. Throw odd shit in on the fly and think about how to take care of it. Think on it until your response becomes instinctual, because there are many times you won't get to think it through. You'll only have time to react. They both sit quietly with the gears turning in their heads. Heat waves shimmer in the distance, turning the end of the runway and the buildings beyond into a blur. Now, one last thing. No matter how right you do things, you may lose people. That's just a fact. You can't account for every variable. That doesn't mean you did it wrong. Although you may feel bad, it doesn't always mean you did something wrong. Analyze it, as with anything else, but move on. If you think too much about one life that is lost, you'll forget about those who are still living, I add, watching the shimmers dance. Don't forget. Just forgive.
Lynn always says that you're too hard on yourself and blame yourself when we've lost people in the past, Bree says.
She told you that? I ask.
No, I've just heard her talking to herself when she didn't think I was around,
Bree answers. Well, you take my advice on this one, because I obviously have no use for it, I reply.
Ha ha, very funny, Dad,
Bree says. Hey, they can't all be gems, I say. And in your case, none of them can, Greg says. We all turn to see him standing at the top of the ramp. Hey, don't you have a hole you have to go fall in? I say, waving him beside us. See, you're proving my point, he says, walking down and sitting. You good? I ask Robert.
I'm good.
Are you up for talking about things and planning some? I ask Greg.
Anytime.
Okay, I want you to play devil's advocate to a degree, and let's talk our way through this, especially the jump, I say.
No worries on that, as I'm already a little leery of it, Greg says.
We have a waxing moon past half, so if it remains clear, we should have some light to guide us, I begin. So, let's look at that for starters. Day versus night.
Well, day is better to jump for obvious reasons. We can guide in better and allow for any alterations earlier. But we can be seen, and they may even notice the aircraft overhead. Night is riskier, again for obvious reasons. But they'll most likely be inside and won't see either us or the aircraft. Plus, if they are inside, any aircraft noise will be hidden. Not like they can hear one that high anyway,
Greg answers. How about a sunset drop, I ask.
Not as risky as a night drop, but there is the chance of being seen. If timed right, though, they should be inside. However, we don't know their habits. Them being walled up like that, they may hang outside until later.
Is it worth the added risk of being seen?
I'm not sure about that one, Greg answers.
Well, the thing I'm thinking about with that one is that Robert, and I'm sure Craig, hasn't conducted a night landing in the 130, especially with NVGs. They'll have to if we drop at night. That means we'll have to practice those tonight and drop the next day if we decide on a night drop.
And that's one of the things I was worried about, Robert chimes in.
All right, let's table that and come back to it, I say. How do you feel about the Halo jump itself?
Not good, to be honest. We could deploy at a high altitude and glide in, although that would mean oxygen, and I'm not really a fan of going back in there,
Greg answers, pointing to the small building we exited not too long ago. Plus, we'll have to add some warmer clothing, I say. There's also the fact that we won't be able to see the ground if there isn't enough lighting or if there's cloud cover. I'd hate to steer halfway over the country and come up short. If we had reliable GPS equipment, okay, but that option isn't really available. We could deploy at a higher altitude rather than the normal 2,500 feet. That would give us some margin for error, I say.
I like the idea. What are you thinking, then? Greg asks.
Well, say at around 3,000 feet above ground, I answer. We won't be able to see the ground at that point, and we'll be at the mercy of the winds to a greater extent. And our accuracy falls with each foot higher above the ground we deploy.
What about a lower drop altitude? Robert asks.
And we could, but the 130's a noisy machine, and not only heard from a long ways off, but felt as well, I answer.
How easy is it to program the drop point? Greg asks. I was thinking we could make a determination of the deployment altitude based on the visibility over the target.
Not very, really. It can be done en route, but that takes time, and the decision would have to be made early in the flight, I answer. If we decide on a sunset drop, we can determine the altitude before we leave.
Are we leaving from here or Cannon?
I'm thinking from here and then land at Cannon. If we drop at sunset, that'll give Robert time to get back with some light left, as it's only 100 miles away.
So you're leaning toward the sunset drop, Greg asks.
The more I think about it, the more I like the idea. We have light to correct, and Robert has light to land. We don't know the winds, although we'll be able to know what the winds are at altitude, and I just don't want to deploy and find that we're going to land outside the walls. That thought does not give me warm and fuzzy feelings, I answer.
So, a sunset drop, then, with a low or mid-shoot deployment?
Low deployment unless we see we're far off target. We'll each have to make our own determination on that. If we do notice we've been spotted, we'll make for the compound we spotted to the south and hole up behind those walls, provided we have the altitude for it, I reply. Greg nods. So we're at 5,355 feet here, according to the charts. Lubbock's around 3,256 feet. Because we don't know the pressure changes, let's plan for a 3,000-foot chute deployment. If we zero out the wrist altimeters here, we should deploy at 1,000 feet on the dial over Lubbock, I continue. Greg gives me a funny look before asking,
How good were you at math in school?
Pretty good, I answer.
Okay, 1,000 on the dial it is, he responds.
So, what do you think? Make for a landing on the large central building?
I think so. That's the only place we found a possible way in other than the ground-level doors, he says.
I'm thinking they're holed up in one of the wings, possibly with a group in one of the buildings, and the prisoners, assuming that's what they are, in the other. I don't think they would actually separate themselves in the other wing. It's too far away, I say.
I agree, but which one? There are two of them, and it'll be a challenge getting to just one, I think, Greg says.
Let's get Jim in on this, I say. Greg rises and returns with Jim. Where do you think they would be holing up?